actually good questions.
All right. Yes. This is a hard parsha. I give you hard questions. Yeah. Okay. You guys are up to it. Dan, roll. What's the first question?
No, go. What will happen if...
Go for it, Josh.
Sorry. Oh, what's the first question? What will happen if Moshe counts the Jews directly?
Okay, this is a classic question. So the parsha opens up that Moshe is told by Hashem to count the Jews via the hashtag, you know? Or if he doesn't do it, what's going to happen? It'll be a
plague.
Hello? What's up with that? Okay, very strange. Okay, this is a major principle. Anyone want to take a shot at it? So then, how does that help? Does that make the problem even worse? Like, what's up with evil eye? What is evil eye?
It's bad luck.
Does that mean? Is there bad luck?
Isn't it kind of, I heard it almost analogous to, like, stones locking up a pathway of spirituality? Okay, or never mind.
No, I'm thinking
like the
Iron Horror.
I mean,
like,
the evil eye.
What is evil eye?
And so basically...
I'm going to give you a rational explanation. I'm going to share the idea of Rabbi Soloveitchik of the evil eye, okay? Which is not mysterious, not dealing with the issue of, you know, no, there's no zapping, there's no spirits, there's no anything. In that regard. And we will connect it to the counting issue. It didn't relate to the counting. Because that really Rashi brings that in. Alright. What is the evil eye? The evil eye, imagine. I have such a good example. It's just awesome. You are an executive at AIG. Okay? And you've already benefited from $170 million of governmental dollars. The failure took us out, which seems no end in sight. And you have, for your tremendous work in the derivatives department,
which sank the economy in the first place,
you decide to share with three of your friends that you are getting a $1 million bonus. What is going to be the reaction?
Jealousy. A little bit more
anger, outrage.
I mean, powerful emotions will emerge. Anger, every kind of negative, everything. People will talk about you. They might companion you. You know, the aggression might get to a point. They might call up, the attorney general to get you subpoenaed that you were, I don't know, that you're a thief, whatever. Any kind of bad thing that can happen to you will happen to you because you wanted to have the satisfaction of lording over them by flashing your cash of $1 million. Okay? That is Ayin Hara. Ayin Hara is doing an activity which demonstrates what you're doing to show dominance over others, that you are superior, which of course brings out a tremendous amount of envy and aggression. Case two.
But that defines what causes Ayin Hara.
I understand that. That's what Ayin Hara is. Ayin Hara is the eye of the evil person.
Who see other people?
Yes, who see, who react, who are also, their whole life is the rat race, and they want to be the top dog. And when you lord over them to overshoot them, they have one interest: to dethrone you. Okay.
Wait, so the other people are the...
I know, I mean, you bring out the evil eye as the eye of the other person who sees your success, your wealth, your greatness, and have a tremendous need to destroy you.
But for good reason, or just...
No.
No.
There's no good reason.
No, it's evil.
Not a good reason, the example you just chose.
No.
That's extreme.
Because it's not their friend's job to speak bad about the guy to 10 people, to Lashon Hara guy, the guy. Now, just because he was an idiot to share that information, and you should have kept that a complete silence, you know, maybe you should give it back, whatever. Whatever you should do, that's something you should be, but they're not doing it as an act of justice. People are not responding to him in an act of justice. They want to get the guy. Let me give you more, let me give you a less explosive issue. Let me give you another example. Imagine on the Upper West Side, you have a woman who's in an apartment of four other girls. And she comes home one night.
And they're all poor and single?
Whatever.
Flashing her finger.
Okay? And she walks in there, and she has a radiant look in her eye, and she takes her hand, and she slowly puts her hand and lo and behold, there's a glint. And there's the Rock of Gibraltar on it, because she just got engaged. And all the girls are, oh, okay? You can see seething out of their eyes. They want to murder her. I've been on a, you know, my 8,000 bad date. You know what I mean? You know, and, you know, so that would be an example of eliciting Ayn Rand.
But that's
not
the intention.
She's doing it on purpose? Yeah, no, she's doing it. There's a way that the engaged girl holds her hand. It's an art. I can't even do it, but I know when I see it.
Go ahead and turn under my fingernails.
There's a way of holding your hand a certain way to ensure that everybody within a 10-foot radius sees that you got the Rock. Which is there to show, I am the queen. I am the prom queen, and you guys are the losers, and you're on endless bad dates, and I am the victorious person that I go off into the sunset of the okay? That engenders the Ayn Rand big time. Okay? You like that one? You just made it right here. That's it. You gotta be drinking the same stuff that I am. Anyway, so that's Ayn Rand. The story of Yosef is a story of going from Ayn Rand to Ayn Tova. Yosef is as young as you all have learned the story, rather in depth, did things to create a tremendous amount of aggression. He, as the Midrashim says, he was a good-looking guy. He told on them. Hey guys, hear the good news of my wonderful dreams? You know, things that you see. So what did it end up? It ended up in a pit, and then it ended up being sold into slavery. And then again, what happens in Potiphar's house is he gets more and more powerful. He starts to dress nice, and he's a good looking. And he suddenly he's walking down the corridor. He's the man. And who seems to notice him? Potiphar's wife. And she wants to sleep with him. And he puts himself in a bad situation there. And then he ends up being put into jail. And then he was cured of this defect. And then he was able to maintain himself in the quarters of power of Paro's empire for 8 years, from age 30 to 110. And he was able to not evince any kind of envy or aggression from anybody. He was a person that did not bring out the hostility, did not bring out the envy. And he was a person that also, Ayn Tova was a person who was happy with their own lot and not threatened by if other people have success. That's not a natural state of a person. It takes a lot of work. But that's really the life journey of Yosef. From a person who brought out the harshest Ayn Rand to a person who brought out the Ayn Tova.
So what happens is your luck changes, like the course of events changes.
Well, I know.
Like things are going well for you, you show off, you brag, you.
But it's not. But I'm saying, but
and
what
then
I'm,
things just suddenly.
Yeah, but I'm saying it's not just the key. I'm not saying it's not just suddenly. When Pirkei Avot says that the Ayn Rand has three things, but Ayn Rand removes a person from this world. It means for two reasons. One is that the person is committed to work the 100 hours a week for the rat race to get the money so they can pull up to the family simcha in the Lexus, rolling down the window, zzz, having the Rolex dangling out the window, beep beep. Right? Just for that moment, he's working like a dog. He's screwing over people, left and right, so he can have the money, so he's being physically stressing himself out all the time to maintain that lifestyle where he can have the monster McMansion that he can cast a large shadow on everybody else who feels like a poor schlepper. Okay, so that's one thing that's going to kill him, and the other one is that the other people are going to feel aggression against him and want to get him, and will get him by talking about him and undermining him in every way they can. So that's what it means. The way that I saw Vish explain it, it's a completely naturalistic phenomenon. There's no zapping going on.
So all those, like, charms that, like, take away the evil eye.
Or the mercury. You've never seen, like, the boiled mercury?
The lucky charms.
What
about
the Chamsa? The Chamsa is an Arab pagan symbol.
Wow. Really?
Yes.
So why are they selling it all over the place in Mayor Shireem?
Okay. First of all, even I remember 20 years ago, you didn't see that except just among certain Sephardim who lived from Arab countries. Everybody has to understand one thing. All people, every single person has the tendency towards superstition is a natural feeling in everybody. Some more, some less, some culturally enhanced, some culturally the goal is to be completely not superstitious at all. That's the goal. Avinu was not superstitious. What does superstition mean? That means that there are forces out there that you have special little tricks to manipulate. I got a little strength or string, and then I'm gonna, you know, somehow I'm gonna deflect the nutty forces out there. Spirits.
Tzitzit,
as a reminder, says, as the same Shema, who read them all the time, you'll see them, uskar tem, you'll remember, kol mitzvot Hashem. That's it.
It's not a protection thing.
Secondarily, it's a protection in the sense that if a person remembers his mission, his mitzvah mission, he's not going to do dumb things. And the example was a guy in the Talmud, a guy going on the way to a whorehouse, and it was. So the tzitzis were saved him, but it reminded him that he needed to leave the premises.
How come
a mezuzah?
What?
Sorry, a mezuzah kind of makes a sanctuary of your house. God is dwelling within that space. It's like
God is not dwelling here.
Well, not he's not. He's not.
Right. Okay.
It makes it into a more holy
everywhere.
Place.
Okay, in a certain sense, yes.
And in the sense that your home is supposed to be the holiest place, not the synagogue. Your home is.
Well, the way that the Rambam describes the impact of because what's in the mezuzah is the two first paragraphs of Shema. When a person encounters, and what is the two first paragraphs of Shema? That is the mission and vision statement of the Jewish people. God is one, the mitzvah to love God, the mitzvah of learning Torah and teaching yourself and your future generations, and there's war and punishment.
So it's like a tzitzit in the
exactly,
reminder.
It's identical, it's a reminder.
So then how come, like, I know so many religious families where if something goes wrong, they're like, oh, we have to get our mezuzahs checked.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That has no halachic basis whatsoever.
That's a couple of things.
But how about the 7 years?
So the mitzvah is, okay, see, Marv is on the money. If you look at the Shulchan Aruch, it says, you have to since the mezuzah is out can be affected by the elements. You need to check your mezuzah twice in 7 years. So every 3.5 years, you bring it to the sofer, he checks it, and you're done. If 5 minutes after he checked it, and he said it's kosher, the humidity, whatever, caused a letter to, let's say, split or fall off, whatever. You're doing the mezuzah 100%. That's your obligation. That's it. There's no idea. In my opinion, that is a primitive idea. And I'll say this, just because Jews do it does not make it a Jewish idea. You got to be discriminated.
But the Hamza, I heard, was like the hand of Miriam or something.
What happens is when superstition comes incorporated into the culture, they become Jewified. This is why you have to look. You have to do research. I mean, not from you, but it has to be research. This is from the Arab pagans, not a Jewish thing.
Not even Arab Muslims.
Not even Muslims who were pagans.
So
it's
like having
I'm
sorry, like a keychain or something like that, or
I would not have. Oh,
and it's got tefillat adarach on it.
You're wonderful. I would not.
That's the funniest part.
Do your research, Mr. Jones.
If you're gonna go to Israel, you're gonna see if like, the place is filled with it.
Yeah,
one of the things that really, truthfully, what makes the experience of the whole hotel experience very negative is the fact that both entrances, well, two main entrances, actually, maybe all three, is you have people selling the registry. And that really is a disgrace. The registry is, the capital that, Madonna has one.
Yeah.
It's a capital
registry. Sometimes it's got a little humps on it.
Right. It's a combination. And it doubles the power. And with a little eye on that.
Yeah.
What is that? What's coming in? Who's selling it?
To me, it would violate a biblical commandment to wear that. Because it's a violation to her halot nafashu. what you're not supposed to be involved in divination, which means I can do a ridiculous action and assume that it's going to produce something else. Okay? For example, classic case. I walk out of my house, a black cat walks past my walkway. Oh, bad day, can't go to work. Right? That's all. If I do that, I violate a Torah violation. I'm having a bagel and cheese, and the cheese fell this way. Oh, the cheese that fell out that way. That means I should invest in Microsoft, whatever. If a person makes these crazy, non-sequential, irrational things, it's a biblical violation.
What's the name of the
walking under
glass? Lo tinach
hashu.
You shall not divinate.
Well, what's
divination?
The red string supposed to represent?
I mean, no, people believe it's going to take away the evil eye.
Oh.
But the idea, the evil eye is not, whatever, it's something which
I
is
don't
not...
It's the evil eye is something that's elicited from your actions.
Yes,
and
correct.
It's a reaction
yes,
to how you're
correct.
Behaving.
Yes, that is...
But it's not just like out there in
right,
the atmosphere.
Right. Let me pause that. There are people, there are people that have interpreted the Zohar to view it as a force. I think they're not reading the Zohar properly because the Zohar is not to be meant to read. It's all midrashic. It's not to be meant literally. It's really how the esoteric secrets are hidden. So if you take literally, you're going to have all kinds of crazy stuff. And what you see is you see all kinds of crazy stuff. Okay? If something really sounds crazy, you got to do research. Either, you know, maybe because you don't know about the mitzvah, like since I don't know what's going on with the strings, a legitimate question. And sometimes the red string, ironically, just, you know, on the point of the red string here, the Tosefta, which you guys learned about, is the outtakes of the Mishnah, says in the seventh chapter of Shabbat that it was the way of the Amorites to wear a red string. So there's a violation called Darkei Amori, doing the ways of the Amorites. What is it? Red string. Right there. Oh,
wow.
I mean, it's this ancient thing.
Wow.
I was in a taxi. I know he was Bangladeshi. I don't know. He had a red string also. It's superstition. You should avoid that at all costs.
Is it okay to own these things if you don't assign superstitious intent to them?
A lot better. I wouldn't. I can't say a lot of things. I can't make a conclusive thing.
Okay.
I personally, I mean, because it's something which, personally, I think it holds people back. Imagine you're out of court. We have a number of lawyers here, okay? Imagine you have everybody's in the room and watching Bernie Madoff, okay? And the judge is about to think about to proclaim that he's in fact guilty on 11 charges of everything, okay? And then he spots out of the corner of his eye, he's wearing a red string. You're wearing a red string! You're free! You're free! You're free! You're wearing the red string! Would that be justice? No! So if something is destined to have bad something happen to him, then if it's a divine justice, then maybe you should get the whack. And if you don't, why is the red string? Is that a real justice? That person who wears the red string, they're saved from the bad stuff. Person who doesn't wear the red string, they get the bad stuff. It's not. It would be. It's a violation of God. Superstition is a violation of God's justice. You're saying that I can affect it by completely irrelevant things. Wearing this color string, it doesn't make. It would be an act of complete injustice, right? We're going to let Bernie Madoff off because you're wearing a red string. I mean, that's it.
Okay,
all right, so one at a time here. We're going to go to Ruth, we're going to go to Marvin, and then we're going to go to Michael.
So,
I'm going to bring it back to Callie. But,
I'm trying to understand this idea, but it's making me think, like, I've heard from people, like, oh, if you say the Katha Mazon with lots of intention, then, like, your Palmasan, your whatever, has a chance of getting better. Isn't that also superstitious then?
First of all, when we say that in Devarim that God is, you know, great, mighty, and awesome, the Lotikach show does not take any bribery. The Sforno says, will not take bribery? How do you bribe God? With mitzvot. I'll throw God an enthusiastic benching. And I want to see $100,000 in the account here by tomorrow. Okay? Now, on the other hand, the Birkat Hamazon is designed to help a person put him back in reality, that he is not the master of his own success, and that the sustenance that he receives is emerging from a system which is far greater than himself. He has to recenter and reground himself after he enjoys the fullness of the meal. That's really the thing. So if there's real focus, and he's a different person, there could be a different destiny. Not by, I say it with, you know, lots of volume, and singing really lustily, hey, Baro, you know what I mean? You know what I'm saying? That, you know what I'm saying? Was the benching transformational? Did it change the persona? Yes. Then then you're a different person. There could be a different destiny. But it's like then they make it sound like a little childish game. Like, I got three loud benchings in the account. I should have some.
But maybe it puts. Forgive me, because it does sound kind of blasphemous.
Yeah, this is the class where you share your blasphemy. That's what it is. It should be
blasphemous.
So you're praying.
Yes.
You also have to buy into a system. My prayer is such and such, and I will say it with intention, and I will try to concentrate, and I will this, and I will that. And, you know, I hope that by doing these mitzvot and da-da-da, that at some point, something, I wear this, let's say, red string, I don't know if it means anything, but let's hope it couldn't hurt to have that on.
Right, I can't hurt, right. In our whole study of tefillah, that we've been underscoring the point that tefillah is not bribing God. We're not trying to butter him up by saying he's being wonderful, but really it's really a way for us to leave our small illusionary world of social reality and try to get into the big picture. It's really it's a way to transport us, and if we are a certain kind of personas, there is reward. But it's not tit for tat. It's not like, you know, in not a way necessarily we can perfectly calculate.
How about the other way around?
You know what I'm saying? So, you have to say, well, is there an idea of, a person wears a red string? What am I doing? What's the purpose of this? So,
you're playing a game with the red string.
Right.
Maybe I wear the red string.
Right. No, that's what people say. So then people answer me and says, come on, Rabbi. What's the harm? I think it's a profound harm. You're saying God's unjust because you're going to wear the string. You're going to have an advantage for a person who's not a string wearer. Okay? That's what you're really saying. And B, first of all, you're saying there's certain forces out there that you can somehow manipulate. So it's really, but isn't that an illusion? Since you feel so vulnerable, that's a healthy vulnerability. You know, don't try to fake. That's a false illusion of having that little red string.
But isn't it like an attachment in the same way? Oh, I'm attached to this red string because maybe it's going to bring me something.
Not anything.
I'm attached to the idea that if I do the tefillah, then something.
No, but I'm saying, but there's no mitzvah. In fact, what I'm trying to make the case is there is no obligation of wearing a red string, and just the opposite, there is a prohibition of wearing a red string. So. Now, why so pervasive in the Jewish community or even the non-Jewish community? Because it appeals to very basic emotions. I want to do something really easy, which will give me an advantage. The end. Very simple. And not only that, it's naturally stylish, so I can't even go wrong. It's like a win-win-win-win-win.
Could some people be wearing it like CC, where it's like it's kind of...
But there's no obligation to do that. You're adding to the, then you're getting another problem. You're adding to the mitzvahs. There's 630. Now the new one. Wear the red string. Where'd it come from?
614.
Yeah.
This is my question. The problem that I had last week. So this class, if it would have happened before last week, would have been kind of interesting.
Okay. Well, it's still interesting.
I'll
try.
I had a secret situation. I've never put on a red string myself.
Yes.
I've never had anyone put a red string on me. I've never worn a chamza or had a chamza hanging in my house.
Okay, fine.
But last week I was meeting with a Syrian business colleague.
Yep.
His son, he goes to Chabad, he's into Kabbalah a little bit, kind of stuff. I think he's from a traditional home. He has a son who was in a terrible ski accident last year.
Yep.
I don't know if it was because of the ski accident or the ski accident revealed something else going on, but he had some sort of swelling or growth on his spine, and he's been walking with two cane. So he's been in the hospital now for 2 weeks, and they've done spinal. They don't know if they, now today, this morning, I haven't heard what has happened, but they were going to do surgery, I think, for a biopsy to see what exactly that swelling is that seems to be causing him the problems walking. So last Friday, when I was meeting with him, he asked me to put on a string, rapid 8 times, and say something or other.
Eight times.
I had
What?
Eight times.
Okay. Eight times. Again, I didn't know what I was doing, but I knew his situation was bad.
Okay.
This was some level of comfort for whatever.
Okay, fine.
Even knowing this information, even if I had, unless it was like a massive disagreement, would it be really that
you know, you know what I do in that situation, which happens to me not infrequently? When I hear, first of all, anybody's response should be, when I hear somebody's ill, I say, can you tell me their name? I will do two things. I'll add them to my regular tefillot. I will daven for their health. And we'll add them, we'll say Mishnah Berurah. And that's the proper Jewish response. And everybody's happy with that. That's it.
So what if he says, cool, can you help put the string on?
He's sitting very pushy. So.
Yeah. I'm not going to put on the restroom. I do.
Well, no, I know. I didn't.
Right, no, I'm not saying no, but I asked him. I'm saying that you asked me what I would do. Yeah. I would find a diplomatic way to avoid answering that question in the affirmative.
And I had no idea. Avoidance. I've never done it myself.
I understand that. I'm not here again, guys. I want to say I'm not here. The goal of this thing is not to let's pick on, let's find some Jews we can pick on. That's not the purpose here. The goal is to really to reveal things. Now this goes back and because we brought this up because the not counting seems to be highly superstitious. What's going on here? Here's the bottom line. We don't want to dwell on the time here. Is that counting? Why does in 2010 does the United States want to take a census?
Depends on your answer.
Help figure out how to spread the money.
Part of the idea of feeling strong as an American or a Chinese or a French person is that we have a nation which has 350 million people. We have an army which has 2.7 million military men in it. Service people. We have an army with 10,000 fighter jets. Part of the idea of here is the idea of that what Hashem is communicating to Moshe is that Jewish nation has to be like a nation like none others, which we cannot give in to the natural tendency to herald and glorify human power. Because the natural, because basically in the world of domination, where there's a war against all of them, whoever is bigger and more stronger, and more, we call them power politics, a person feels a sense of tremendous security by having a sheer force of numbers. Now, you need to know the number here. So, What Hashem was communicating to the Jewish people through by Moshe, we're going to count because we need to make certain military arrangements. You need to know how many fighting men you have. But we're going to do it as an act of service. This half shekel is going to be used for the construction and maintenance of the Mishkan. Why is it an atonement to the person? Because by doing the counting in this kind of sacrificial and national service manner is going to inoculate the person from falling to the trap that we have 600,000 fighting men and we can kick their butt, whoever they may be. Okay? In fact, there's a powerful story in the Tanakh, in the story of Gideon, where he has 10,500 soldiers. And Hashem communicates to him, the prophet, you have too many people. And if you go out to war, you're going to ascribe that success to yourself. Reduce the fighting force. They end up going down to 300. Okay? So there's a tremendous tendency to want to view that our national success is emerging from our physical political might. You know, in fact, you go to a corporation, you have a person in charge of human resources. That very term is a very non-Jewish term. A human is never a resource. It's not a physical, economic object that can be bought and sold in a very reductive manner. That's why, so we don't count a Jew for two reasons. One is because you're reducing him into a physical, material being when he in fact has a tzel melokim. That's one reason. And two is that we don't want to get lost into the nationalistic fantasy that our success emerges strictly through pure power politics. If the Jews do that, then they've lost their entire mission and they will get recorrected through a plague. It's not a minor thing. It's a major. It's really the problem is in the Jews believing their success emerging from pure might. We say every morning in the Tefillah, we say Ela Barecha ve'Ela Basusim ve'Nachdu b'Shem Elokim Naskir. They are successful with horses, mighty steeds. Other with chariots, and we by mentioning Hashem, our God's name, which means that our relationship to Hashem is going to be the make it or break it thing. Doesn't mean that you go to war with one person. I mean, Esther did everything she could, but fundamentally, what's going to make, as far as the Jewish destiny, is not going to be our physical might alone. It's going to be our connection to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. If we do have that, we're going to be successful. And if we don't have that, we're going to have a billion Jews, we're going to be unsuccessful. That's the fundamental idea of not counting. So to keep that idea, in the temple, when they wanted to count people for the, they had to divide the jobs of who are the Kohanim are going to do the service. The Kohanim would gather, who were part of that watch, would gather in a circle, they'd stick out their thumbs, and they'd count the thumbs. Let's say, whoever they're going to do, let's say the incense. So let's say number 18. They'd count 18 thumbs, and the 18th thumb, that guy would do it. They want to count people, because reducing what a Jew is, And you're getting lost into the nationalistic notion of what is power. That's not Jewish power. Just
I get to the first point, but I don't really understand how. Like you're still counting. Like
okay.
You're counting
the problem is not so that so that's the point. So you can ask the question what Jesse's asking. One second. At the end, they're still going to know they have 603,550 Jews who are of male and a fighting age above age 20. You're still going to get that number, right? The problem is not the counting per se. It's what counting elicits in the psyche of a person naturally. They have to do it in an indirect therapeutic manner, which they don't fall into the trap that we are going to be kicking some butt. We've got 600,000 Rambos. We're going to take those Edomis down. Okay? That's the problem. So they do it as an act of charity and of service. So it's there to do it. They're doing it as an act of service is actually, and that's actually why it's an atonement. It means it's a correcting of the of that very defect of thinking that their success emerges by being successful in power politics. Purely naturalistic. That's the idea. So that's why you'll go into a shul and they'll count the men via a verse. Or she has a macrograph, not several, or they'll count kippah, or they'll count arms. So there's basically, those are the two basic reasons. Now it connects into, let me make last, another, it connects into Ayin Hara, because Ayin Hara is people who are competing within power politics. Whoever does the most stuff wins. So if I have the most amount of money, and the biggest house, and the most beautiful wife, and the fanciest cars, and the biggest business, I'm the lord of the land. That's it. So that's Ayin Hara is a person who is struggling to find success in being the ultimate mocker lord. And basically, this is to extract the Jews from that whole process.
Can you go back into the... this is going to come up in everyone's life. Back to the red string, so you actually know, in a very nice way, how to...
Don't say anything. Don't say anything. Because you personally... My general point is, if you don't have the relationship... And B, the conviction that you have an impact to open to their mind. Now, I'm not going to go around to a person who's, say, at MG, right? We have a party, whatever. Party, cocktails on the roof, right? And this girl's coming off the street, and she got the Madonna ass party. They, you, like, what are you wearing there? You idolatrous? You just let it go. Let it go.
But for instance, I have a client. And her mother is really, really into Kabbalah. And she wears this string every time she comes in. And they had her change her name because she had a different Hebrew name and she needed to change her aura or whatever it is. So they gave her a different name.
Okay.
They changed it to Rachel. So she was asking me, what do you think of, Rachel? And I was like, oh, don't get started.
No, 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 right.
Whatever. I'd like to be able to say, this is why I don't believe in it without offending them. But it's important
why?
To know why. You can't just say no because I don't do Kabbalah stuff.
No. Just because Ravi Tal, just because you may be correct doesn't mean it's time to make for you to make the case. Because if she's into the Kabbalah center, let's say she's a Kabbalah center devotee, and she believes all whatever that she, I don't even know, right? Is that the point of contact where you're going to have a positive? What's the chance of your success, other than losing a client? Other than that, I will guarantee that will happen. But other than she's saying, "Oh, Robin Chow, what a penetrating insult insight." If that person is,
you're right, I'm wrong.
Right, if a person is that wedded to that whole concept, that's not where you're going to have a moment. That's not a location of influence, because there's a lot of energy wrapped up into that whole thing, whatever that thing is. So you're not going to go there.
People do it to us all the time. If someone offers me food and I'm fasting, or if someone offers me unkosher food or whatever, and I have to say no, I can't, I'm kosher. It's the same thing. They'll say, "Well, what does it matter?" Or if I can't do something,
no.
My point is, the other people that they'll try to push it on you because they'll try to prove their point. So
fine,
it doesn't work.
Well, no, but I like to know their point of view.
Okay, so but my point is, here's the question. You have to make an assessment. What chance do you have to be able to shift her paradigm?
I think I have a great chance.
Why do you think that?
Because I'm a really good speaker.
She's
very open. She doesn't know what she's doing. I ask her these questions in a completely non-confrontational way. Just like, "Oh, why do you guys do that?" Or, "Oh, how did you get into the box?" Completely non.
That's fine. That's cool.
And I ask these questions and she has no idea. She's like, "Oh, I don't know, just because my mom is blah, blah, blah." And she has all these celebrity friends. She's very, very wealthy. Her dad actually built that Kohen, where the Kohenim lived, that site that we went to, the wall, something wall. That's her grandfather.
Okay.
She doesn't know anything about the religion other than her mom got a little crazy and got into Kabbalah, and she's always asking me questions.
Okay, so answer her questions. I would, you know what I would define more for? Answer her questions about everything else. Don't go, if that's something she's very wedded to, don't have a conversation at the point of maximum resistance.
Invite her to a
Invite her to
MJ.
I did. I'm trying to get her to make a
That's a better situation. Have her talk to her. All right.
Invite her to the annual dinner. It's very good for her in Kabbalah chi.
Kabbalah chi.
Right. You can tap for meridians there. You know what I mean? There'll be no tapping to anybody's meridians. Okay. Anyway, so, you know what I'm saying? That's my advice. Look, I can't. I don't. You know what I mean? The wise person does not say unless they feel it'll be heard. Okay. You have to make an assessment. I can't know. You'll know. If they're open, fine. If they're not, but a person. What I made earlier comment is that superstition is not just a very externality. It runs very, very deep. You just can't just let's use a stereotype. You know, many grandmothers are superstitious. You just can't go in there and say, do you really believe? What the hell? I mean, right? That is not. You have to. That's not a person that you're not going to have an effective. So just be nice and talk about something which is positive elsewhere. You're not going to. People, you're assuming. Let me take a one layer more here. You're assuming that people relate to their cherished beliefs in purely irrational categories. They're logical. But if you look in their entire life, it's completely illogical. People do not determine their beliefs strictly on logic. In fact, that's a rare phenomenon. That's a very high-level person. Those people are few and far between. Right? So you're going to give a dialectic, a Socratic argument why they should flee from this superstitious trend?
Not flee. I mean, not to harp on this subject, so I want to get off it. If someone were to ask me why you're not using your cell phone on Shabbat, I would feel very, very comfortable giving them an explanation on why. If she offered me a red string, which she has before, and I said no without any further comment, I would like to let her know why I won't.
You can do it in a way. You can
inadvertently letting her know the idea behind it. Because maybe she doesn't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
But you gotta feel that out. You gotta know when you're gonna be successful enough.
But that was the thing. I don't know why the red string.
No, but I didn't. I think I answered that question.
You did. You said a Hebrew term, but I didn't get to write it down.
No, Lo Tanach Hashu. There's a biblical thing involved in divination.
There wasn't a different one specifically for the Amorites that you're not supposed
to. Well, it's also another. That became a specific Amorite superstitious practice of the Red Spring itself.
Right, and there's no name for that. Just
well, the Hebrew name is Darkei Haemori, the Way of the Amorite. That's never a compliment.
That's so weird how it started all over again.
Yeah, I know.
Isn't that bizarre?
No, if you understand psychology, it makes sense.
But it can't be on the Red String, though.
It's funny why they're dressing objects.
Yeah,
that's very interesting. All right, now that's good. All right, let's move on. All right, we did one. All right, we have one question.
Oh, good. Yeah, no, we did two.
Oh, no, we did two.
Okay, now let's keep on rolling. Keep on rolling.
Why is the Torah so particular that Kohen washing his hand and feet prior to serving Mishkan?
Okay.
Rabbis also rule the person washing his hand before davening.
Okay.
Well, actually, yeah, if we can get into the specifics of that.
Okay. Okay, so the washing of the hand. So you saw that if you read the Parsha, that they have this thing called the Kior, which was a large, special, beautiful dispenser of water, and that the Kohanim would put their hand on their feet and they would wash their hands and feet simultaneously, each one, prior to doing the service. That's called Kiddush Yadayim Ragloim. Before we daven, a person should do the Netilat Yadayim. We don't do it with a blessing because it's an argument if you're absolutely obligated. You do for bread, you know, water on the left, water on the right, with a cup. Before you daven. What is that? What is that idea? And also, not only an idea, but if a guy would just go in there willfully, not do it, say, I'm just going to go in as is, he would be getting struck down, which means that he does not get any world to come unless he repents on that. It's a very harsh, seemingly very harsh punishment for a very innocuous activity.
You're saying why if you...
What's the point? And why is it so harsh if I don't do it? That's my question. Isn't that a basic question? Michael Doze. Give it up for Michael Doze.
I would say it's part of davening with intent. It's a physical act of preparation that you do to purify yourself before davening so that you're entering into this with a clear mind and intent of what you're going to do. It's not just a casual thing.
Very good. I like that. What you're saying is true. We can take it a step higher. What in other words, ironically, let's flip it around, what would be a defect of the Kohen who walk in there and not wash his hands? What would that demonstrate?
No respect.
Disrespect.
See, the key thing is that the epicenter or principle of the Mishkan and the temple is like this, is to create an aura of uniqueness and exclusivity and honor to the place. So therefore, clothes have to be beautiful, the vessels have to be beautiful, and the service to be done in a most honorable manner. Okay? So if I'm going to do it in my hand, possibly even dirty, I'm viewing this as a mundane, irrelevant, just a chore. Versus that I have been elected to represent the entire Jewish people in doing a special service. So to not do it is to really reduce the entire character of the thing. And remember, it's not a personal activity. The Kohen is doing a national service. He's doing it for everybody.
What's the significance then of the hands and feet versus the whole body, like a mikvah?
Well, okay, that's very true. So there are two levels. On Yom Kippur, there are five immersions and five of the Kiddush Yadayim Raglayim, a total of 10 times. Why does one thing demand one? I don't know. It's a very good question.
Were those done in the same bowl at the same time? The feet and the hands together?
Well, they put the hand on the feet. They do like this. They're also barefoot.
Is that what they do now, too?
No.
Okay.
They do like this, and they pour on their hand on both.
Really?
One shot, yeah.
So what happens if they don't touch their feet?
Someone else, the Levites pour
it
for them, right? Is that what it is?
No, it opens up the thing of water and they pour it on it.
Okay.
So.
So did that ensure then that the Kohen had like a level of physical fitness? I'm actually quite serious.
Well, they don't have to bend down, they can cheat and bend their knees.
Yeah, but there's some,
I mean, it's a masterful demonstration of athletic prowess.
Some people.
Okay, look, you know.
Wait, so on a practical question, yes. I'm going back to washing the other hands.
Yes.
Let's just say if I'm at someone's home,
yes.
they don't have a cup, and I want to make kamotzi. What does one do then?
They don't even have a plastic cup?
Oh, you can use any plastic cup then.
Right. You can use any. Ideally, you should use a permanent cup. Any metal or glass. It doesn't have to be kosher.
Even one that they use to drink out of?
Yes.
Oh.
That's it.
Is it the same reason? We were just talking about this, actually, on Shabbos. Some people, like, after you have a meal, but before you bench?
Yeah, called mayim achronim.
Yeah,
mayim achronim. So mayim achronim, again, according to Maimonides, he maintained you have to do the same washing of the hands you did before the bread, but without a blessing. It was done because there was a fear. The question is that really now obligatory then? Because they had a category of salt which would create blindness occasionally. So therefore, they wanted to, before you finish your, when you finish your meal, to wash off your hands. So, but we don't melech sedomi. It's not clear that we don't have that. We don't have that toxic salt. I don't know what that was.
Is there ever a halacha to do that thing?
Yeah. So there's, that's one reason. According to the Tosfos, they maintain this additional reason of, which is similar to the Mishkan, is that your hands should be, if your hands are dirty, let's say you have bread, you have fried chicken, you're deep in there, right? So, no, I'm talking about, okay? So your hands, you should wash your, not only just wash them, but you should do an atila before the benching, according to that position.
But how come it's in so many circles?
He'll do the little thing. That is
even... Well, it's men only, as I should ask. Especially
with
the salt.
To me.
Come on, Bobby Paul.
Women don't need to stay.
Much better to control them. Come on, it's obvious.
It gives them lots of attractive guys a chance.
Oh, you know, good thing that we clarified that one. Okay. Now the obligation would be equal to men and women. Again, according to the Rambam, it would be not an obligation nowadays. But according to the others, if you're going to do it, these little cups that people do is also, luckily, it's like not a real washing, because there should be a cup which can maintain 3.5 ounces of water, and you pour it in each hand. All right, how are we doing? Let's keep on cruising. I want to finish.
Can I just have, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
So when you go into shul here, like, you wake up in the morning.
Yes.
You wash your hands.
Okay, so that really, the washing should be, okay, so that... Well, the washing is... that washing in the morning.
Like on Shabbos morning, if you get up and wash your hands, and then you know you get dressed to go to shul, and are you supposed to wash your hands again before you enter sanctuary?
Yeah, but without a blessing, you should do that ideally. Okay, at least according to Maimonides. Not everybody holds that would be an obligation, but at least according to Maimonides. I'll leave it like that. That's a very, I'm not going into very super detailed conversation now, but it's a good question.
Thank you.
It's harder than it sounds, believe it or not. Okay, whatever. Good. Why are Jews forbidden making fragrant oil? Oh, this is a tough one. Okay. Why are the Jews forbidden making fragrant oil, especially since that was used in the Mishkan? The Torah states that one who makes incense will get cut off from his deep through evil. See, I don't have a good answer on this question yet. I'm still working on this one.
Is a person?
I'm not going to give you a question. I'm not. What was that? I didn't say that. I will give you all the answers. I don't. Because it's interesting, a lot of questions. Let's say I take the garment of the Kohen and I go and I use it to buff my car. Okay? So that's a terrible violation. I'm using an object which is designated for holy, and I'm violating his identity with something profane. It's called, the Hebrew term is called Me'ilah. Me'ilah. And that's and I would get, if I did it with being warned, I would get whipped. But if I did this, if I made the fragrance in the same proportions, and you didn't smell it, but for smelling, at that point I would get this very harsh punishment of COVID. The question is, what's the distinction? I'm still working on that. I'm gonna.
Well,
yeah.
Okay. I mean, do you want to just skip?
I'm gonna hear somebody else. I'm open to suggestions. I don't want to intimidate you guys.
I don't have my answer
for
me, but I think I put something down along the lines that you're trying to elevate yourself to some supreme holy level above, you know.
But you see that if I would use, abrogate items of the temple, you'd say the same thing. If I'm using the Kohen's garment to buff my car, aren't they doing that? So that is a violation. But this is something. There's something extra.
If you're using it inappropriately to elevate yourself, you're putting it on yourself.
But even if you don't have to put on yourself, even if I just make that, even if I just make it. And the guy who smells it does not get it. It's interesting.
Oh.
So there's an interesting twist here.
So
we're not.
Wait, who's supposed to make it then?
Well, no. If you're the official perfume incense maker for the temple, that's a mitzvah. Now I'm talking about, I want to make it because I want to have a line of fragrance called Mishkanet.
They have candles with this at the Kabbalah Center, my favorite.
Don't get it started, okay. So if you're making torture with me, the leaven spices. They have the myrrh and the frankincense, what I don't even know stuff this. Leaven spices, but the same proportions. If you make that proportions, and then you got the problem. I'm still doing research on that, so maybe I'll have an answer for you.
Is there a concern about desensitizing people to the scent so it doesn't have the same significance?
Mm-hmm. Okay, it's good. It's good. It's good. Why the guy who smells it, though? He does not get the same punishment.
Well, that's what kills my
argument. Not so simple. It's one of these puzzles. There's something, there's a deeper principle here that we're feeling.
This fragrance is annoying. Is the fragrance used to annoy people?
Okay, so there's two things.
So you're taking away part of the ritual.
There's the oil, which was there, which was made to inaugurate our own and the entire vessels. Which, of course, you got the jump question. If it's made for that purpose, why do they need it all together? It's not a question. I didn't ask that, but it's a good question. Okay. This partial, by the way, literally cranked up 500 questions. It's a very challenging partial. Very challenging. So I gave you the questions. Okay, so let's go. I don't have a good answer to that question. I don't have a compelling answer. I'm working on it. I'll give you something, hopefully. Oh, this is a good one. I like this one. Five. Why does Hashem need to add wisdom to the trained craftsmen to create the Mishkan? They were given a very detailed parameters which they do not seem to need such extra talents. This will give you a new insight into the entire Mishkan. Yeah. Is that thing? Just because they're like, they were craftsmen already, so that means that predicates from the verses that they knew how to work with gold and silver, and they knew how to do it. And they didn't have like, they were not told, make a menorah. They were told what it's going to look like, what is going to be the parameters. So what, you know, it's like, you know, in a certain sense, like painting by numbers. I mean, why is God giving them extra chachmah? I mean, there's a whole list of wisdom.
Well, I think they need to understand the meaning and intent behind it, too. That's it.
When they're bringing these vessels into things, it's not simply they're just making in a perfunctory manner. They have to know what are the metaphysical principles that are really these things are associated with. And these the Mishkan actually associates to very, very profound esoteric ideas. And that on their own natural ability, they would not be accident. So when they made it, it would be made for the right purpose. Really the right purpose. What is the true design of this vessel? They had to be given that as a gift. Okay, very good, Dan. Okay, let's move on. Why is it willful? Why is it? Oh, this is a Jew. This, by the way, I asked a question last year. It was intense. But I had to throw it out. I just got to stir the trawl. I can't help myself. I'm like Rabbi Tal already. Why is the willful violation with two witnesses who warned the offender of Shabbat worthy of the death penalty? Isn't that a little harsh? Okay. What do you guys got to say?
Shabbat is part of the eternal covenant between us and God. If you take the advice of one person, you can not believe it. But if two people have both warned you of the same thing and you're choosing to willfully ignore and not even pursue any change at all, then you're basically saying, I'm not a Jew, I'm not part of the covenant, so...
So hold on. Okay. Well, let's say a guy says, don't eat that cheeseburger. If you eat that cheeseburger, what's punishment for cheeseburger? You get a lesser punishment. You get, if you're warned, you get whipped. You get whipped up to 39 times. Eat non-kosher, because I, okay? Willfully, knowingly. Okay,
Shabbat's about.
So Shabbat, more than it's a why. So isn't that also a willful betrayal of the Jewish of the whole covenant?
Kosher itself isn't part of the covenant, though. I mean,
well, part of the Torah.
It says in this parsha that it's a part of the eternal covenant between us and the Jewish people.
True. Okay, so what makes Shabbat so on a pedestal here? Shabbat is like the whole package.
Well, because.
Oh, but
you're breaking your spiritual.
Midrashically, you call it a gift. It's true, but why did it? But It's a gift. But why is the charge also a gift?
By willfully violating, you're breaking your spiritual connection to God and also to the different generations.
Why? Okay, I'm not going to let you guys on about some simple, like, little answers here. Oh, let me give you a case. I'm going to make it really hard for you guys. It's Shabbos afternoon, and I'm in the mood for a little Spanish on. Hi, Sam. Hi, Sam. I go into the kitchen. I'm going three-egg.
Three-egg.
Okay, Shabbos afternoon, I'm getting a little hungry. Okay, it's not a reality because I'm never hungry in Shabbos. Okay, but whatever. But just imagine for a moment, okay? We're going. And while I'm making the egg, which is a biblical violation, as you learn with Rabbi Wiles, ad nauseum. Okay, that is bishul, that is cooking one of the 39, that's a av malacha, that's a major baby, okay? And while I'm doing that, I'm saying, I maintain that God is the creator of the heaven and earth. Salsa? Alright? So I'm saying, and I really believe it, I maintain that God is the creator of heaven and earth. I just want to happen to have and there are two ways that if you, and they have to say the whole, that's why nobody really got killed in the Jewish court, they say, if you do this act of cooking on Shabbat, you will get the death penalty. And the guy says, and I have to respond, I don't care, I'll do it anyways. So let's say, but I don't let you know, but I do believe that God is greater than on earth. So I'm maintaining the covenant. Right?
But your actions are belying your words.
Why?
Because...
Did Avram keep Shabbat?
Supposedly.
No, he didn't.
No?
How did he keep Shabbat? It wasn't yet told to
I thought they intuitively knew or something
they
like
knew,
that.
They knew. So they kept the... The way that I understand the Rambam's son's explanation of that the patriarch kept the mitzvot, was that the goals of the mitzvah, the spiritual development of all mitzvot, they had attained. But the particular forms and procedures they did not do.
Okay.
They're not, because it would be kind of weird. I was wearing tefillin, which is not commemorating an event that not occurred yet. That would make him a pretty silly man. Right?
That's true.
So it's hard to take that metaphor on a literal level. Okay? So Avram maintained that God is greater. He never kept one Shabbos his whole life. Sounds like religious, but it's true. Okay? And as far as the pantheon of humanity, he's up there. Okay, so why am I going to get the death penalty?
Is this a direct response to the sin of the golden calf?
Okay, well, I'm lost on that. Okay, what do you mean by that?
Safeguarding against creating this layer of respect to make sure that people never cross those lines again.
But they don't get a death penalty for every crime. There's a whole hierarchy, it's a whole judicial system. Something gets the highest punishment is the death penalty, which you need warning with two kosher witnesses. And then one below that is karet, which you could do.
Well, obviously the implications is this is the most important.
Okay, you're right. But he gave me the reason that because it's a covenant, which is to maintain that God is creator. So I'm saying I'm gonna declare that God is creator. And Abram maintained God was a creator and he never kept one Shabbos. So you don't need Shabbos to maintain that God is greater. So I ask you, I humbly submit to all you, why is Rosenthal going to get carted off to the basement and be executed?
It's not a question of whether you believe he's the creator or not.
So then what am I doing then? Yeah. Why can't I make an omelet then?
The question doesn't say that God isn't the creator. The question is, you're breaking a law that God...
But it's not just any law. Well, he's saying, the question is, why is it so severe? I think they're correct by saying that it's not just any punishment, any crime, you get any kind of death penalty. Death penalty is extremely harsh.
You're not worthy of life.
Right. Exactly. That means that's huge.
But I'm saying there's a problem with your question.
Why don't we all snap it over Chumash on page 491? Okay. 491. Let's read it out. Page 2, verse 12.
Sure.
We got 3 minutes. I don't know if I'm going to get to all of Shabbat in 3 minutes. That's going to be a little bit of a topic.
Okay.
Okay, verse 12. Hashem said to Moshe, saying, you shall speak to the children of Israel, saying, however, you must observe my Shabbat for the time between me and you for your generation, to know that I am Hashem who makes you holy. You shall observe the Shabbos, for it is holy to you. Its death creator shall be put to death. For whoever does not work on it, that soul shall be cut off from amongst the people. For 6 days work you have made be done, and the 7th day is the day of complete rest. It is sacred to Hashem. Whoever does work on the Shabbos day shall be put to death.
say, in other words.
Okay.
Like, anyone can do and say two different things.
True.
Right?
I agree with you.
And so it's putting yourself above God. If God says X, then you do X. You don't try to find a way to...
So what, but if I do a lesser crime, let's say I eat non-kosher, I don't get the death penalty. So you say I'm putting myself above God. So I'm not listening to his law. That's also part of his law. Not every aspect of his law is punishable by death. Right? So we got literally 60 seconds. Should I let it sit for a week, or should I give you a 60-second answer?
60-second answer.
60-second answer. Okay. May 31st, MG's gonna get together on Fifth Avenue. We're gonna walk down Fifth Avenue together with 100,000 Jews, demonstrating the value and significance and joy of that is the state of Israel. Imagine one of the MGers will take out of their backpack a Hamas flag and start to walk down Fifth Avenue with a Hamas flag. What is the problem? They are showing allegiance and significance to an institution, an organization whose mission is the destruction of Israel. They're undermining it on the moment when you're trying to demonstrate the superiority and the value of the state of Israel. Okay? See, the thing is like this. Shabbat was created as a platform to make a national demonstration, both for Jew and non-Jew alike, that God is a creator. So that platform, which is used to demonstrate the one idea, you, with your actions, Rosenthal, with your Spanish omelet, are demonstrating the absolute opposite. Because the way that we nationally demonstrate that God is greater, we cease from our own personal pursuing of our own agenda and only reflect on God's creation. That's what the day is about. So therefore, if I'm on that day going to take that platform of that day, I'm going to undermine it, and not only undermine it, but tell the two witnesses that I'm going to do it no matter what they say, so it makes it an act of betrayal. I'm betraying the identity and mission of this day on an institution which was designed to communicate just the opposite.
Although, if you're in your house making your omelet and you're alone, you're not demonstrating.
You don't get the death penalty. You don't get the death penalty. It's only with two witnesses. Now, interesting thing. I've got a 15-second MG question. Rabbi, I drive on Shabbat. Is there a value of me parking my car on 89th, walking a couple blocks MG? Or can I just park right on 86th? Hey, look, everybody knows I drive on Shabbat. Is there a value to drive park on 89th?
Absolutely.
Socially. Correct. Now, halachically. Answer yes, because Shabbat is the only mitzvah which has a public dimension to it. It's called a Mechalel Shabbat Beth Farkesia. Person who violates Shabbat in public in front of a witness of 10 Jews. So, MG's coming out, everybody's sitting there at 131, 163, and you go there, you have that. The Maimonides quotes that Thomas says, the person who violates Shabbat Bifaresi in public in front of a Jewish crowd, Dino Keakum. He is equivalent to a non-Jew. Because he is publicly negating the foundation of all Judaism, that God is creator. But if he would have snuck there in 89th Street, he's a public violator. He doesn't get a big pat on the back, obviously. But it's substantially less. It's because he's not making he's not pulling out the Hamas flag and marching down Fifth Avenue on the Israel Day parade. That would be a public demonstration of the opposite.
Just hanging it up on his fireplace.
Right. Okay, that's a 60. A little more than that, but I'm giving you like the teaspoon to walk home with. All right, guys. Have a good night.
That's
not a good
answer.
Do you not get your
stuff?
You like it? I like it.